They're really thinking about, how do I protect my students? How do I make good financial decisions for our schools and our districts? How do I make sure that these tools are really connected to the pedagogical practices that we want to promote?
You know, how are we engaging parents in these conversations? How are we engaging families in these conversations? How do we bring the voices to the table that are being left out, that feel left out, and that if we don't bring into the conversation, we're going to find ourselves with a lot of friction moving forward.
Using AI to get you started might actually be sabotaging us. Instead, we need to be thinking through the complexities and the routing and the benchmarks and the streets and creating that strategic plan in our mind and then using AI to fill in the side streets.
Welcome, everyone, to the AMP to 11 podcast. I am joined, as always, by my incredibly brilliant co-host, Rebecca Boltzma. Rebecca, how are you doing today?
I'm good, but I've spent the week just completely immersed in Claude Code. It's running my whole life in great ways, but I feel like I've been Claude-pilled, they're calling it, where it's like all I do. I'm coming up with new and creative ways to use it and talking about it a lot. So I just kind of feel like I'm down this rabbit hole in Wonderland. So it's good when I have things like podcasts on my calendar to pull me out of the Claude universe. But other than that, I'm doing great.
All right. Well, we're glad you're here. I also started using that. And I told someone today that my brain hurts in a good way after spending a lot of time yesterday trying new tools and trying new things with AI. So I think we're in the same space, but luckily we are joined by two incredible leaders at the intersection of education and innovation. We are joined today by Joseph South, the Chief Innovation Officer at ISTE ASCD, as well as Jessica Garner, the Managing Director of Innovative Learning at ISTE ASCD. Thank you both for joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I wish I was immersed in Claude Code because I've been immersed in Snow Creep, which is the icy snow that's fallen on the DC area. It's a crazy town out here.
Yes, across Virginia. This is day 7 of no school for my child, and tomorrow will be day 8 of no school.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Not to pull out my Trump card, but you know you're talking to a Canadian who lives in the Rocky Mountains, right? So I feel like I outwinter all of you, but I'm sorry you're having to deal with that because I'm sure you don't live where I live by choice. So you have my fullest sympathy for your horrible winters. Know that I have every ounce of empathy for you because I have experienced exactly what you're going through. And right now too, it's quite the winter.
7 days. That is impressive. I think, Rebecca, as always, though, we know like Canada's ready for this. Many parts of the United States have not experienced something of this nature. So you have our empathy, Jessica. And I hope we all get to experience some warmness coming up in the future. But we are so excited to have you both here today. Something we love to do for our audience is really let you tell your own story, right? So you're both leaders at ISTE ASCD. You're really changing how people are navigating education in the age of AI. So if you could both take a moment and just share your journey, your why, and how did you really arrive at this moment in the work you're leading at ISTE ASCD? Jessica, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. So I've been with ISTE ASCD almost a year and a half at this point, and I came from 27 years in public education. I worked for 13 years as a teacher, and then was the North Carolina Teacher of the Year in 2009-10, which kind of shifted my whole trajectory. I worked for a couple of years at the State Department and then led some different district initiatives for about 11 years in two different districts. And so I think I come to this work with less of a technology background and more of a curriculum and pedagogy lens, really with the heart of a teacher looking at all of this. And so I think for me, the why is really about thinking about the learning experience for students. Everything that I did as an educator for 27 years, working in schools and districts and at the state level, was about ensuring a great education for our students. And so I think that that's my why for this as well. I'm trying to create a world that I want my kids to live in, that I want hopefully someday grandkids to live in. And so I think that we are at a really interesting point in the really not just education, but in the world right now. And so I'm just trying to help change a little bit of that if I can.
Amazing. Joseph?
Yeah. So part of my why is working with people like Jessica. That was a fantastic answer. And it is really great in this seat that you work with people who are so committed to helping educators and students thrive. So, my background, I started out in instructional design, really excited about using technology to design new learning experiences that weren't possible without technology. And I stayed excited about that, but I also along the way found that a lot of what I was designing wasn't being used. And part of that was because I was designing it in a way that required technology that was beyond what schools had available at the time. And part of it is because even though I was doing my research and basing it on research-based pedagogy, those pedagogies weren't always accepted in schools. And so I really had to do a reset and ask myself, if I want to have impact, what do I need to be doing differently? And so ultimately that led me to the U.S. Department of Education, where I was the director of the Office of Educational Technology. And then from there on to IDEO, a design firm, for a year, and then to ISTE-ACD, which I've been here for almost 10 years. And I think what changed for me during that time is I realized that one, we got to meet educators and schools where they are. We've got to, work with what we have in front of us. And I love the people who want to go in and blow everything up and make everything new. And we need people who are doing that. But most students are going to experience public school in a very similar way to the way it's been for a long time. And so I really gain energy by working in those settings and helping them get where they need to go.
So for our listeners who might not be familiar with your organization, how would you explain ISTE? How would you explain this merge with your updated name? Joseph, tell us a little bit about what people need to know about the organization and the changes.
Yeah, so I'm super excited about the merging that we've done, in part because there's been a technology conversation happening over here and a pedagogy conversation happening over here, and they need to be the one same conversation. And so what we find is that when schools bring the chief academic officer in the same room with the chief technology officer, and they bring in the leaders, and they say, what are we trying to accomplish from a teaching and learning point of view? Okay, great. Now, how can the technology support that? That's when we have a really interesting conversation. And most of the time, when technology is not effective, it's a pedagogical failure. And not either because we didn't consider the pedagogy first, or because we just didn't consider pedagogy at all, right? We just completely left it out of the conversation. And so the merging was to bring those two conversations together. And I think that some of the ways that that impacts the ecosystem is we now have a merged conference. So our annual conference is the last week of June. It's going to be in Orlando this year. And you can find just as many sessions about research-based pedagogy as you can about the powerful use of technology. We have publications that span that whole continuum. We have professional learning, online courses. We also, Jessica leads all of our face-to-face work with school districts. And then we also have certifications where you can really go deep and learn. And so I think the collective conversation has been really powerful.
I love that, especially as a researcher. I sometimes struggle at EdTech conferences because it's a lot of hype about technology, and then you read things like by Larry Cuban, oversold and underused, all of these things. And there is at a lot of those conferences a disconnect. And so I think that is great. Jessica, my question for you is, what opportunities do you see emerging from this partnership that might not have existed before?
No, that's a really good question. I actually just spent the entire day today with some educators in Northern Virginia, and they're thinking about how they innovate in their schools and what this looks like. And so more than ever, the conversation, I think, between what happens with technology and what happens with pedagogy, they're intersecting right now. So I'll just, a couple of examples. I heard today teachers and leaders talking about using AI to analyze what are the needs of the students in front of me, right? So taking out names, but thinking about how do I put in IEP goals? How do I put in, 504 accommodations? My students who are multilingual learners, like their goals, And then just other kids that I have in my classroom, like what is everybody's needs? Take off all the names, feed that in and say, okay, what do I have going on in my classroom? Where are their similarities? Where are their differences? Help me meet the needs of these students. And so it's coming at it from a lens of what are the activities that I need to do with my students to help them meet their goals, to help them reach the standards. But it's how does the technology support that? And how does the technology enable me to actually have this analysis in a way that would have taken me hours to do as a teacher before? So that's where I see some of this power kind of coming together. And I think, you know, we're also seeing at SCAACD some really interesting overlaps. We have a set of authors that have written a book called AI Enhanced Literacy, right? So looking at reading and writing in the age of AI. And so it's this idea of, we're not just going to talk about the technology for technology's sake, and we're not going to talk about reading and writing and pretend that the technology doesn't exist. It's how do we bring these two things together, and how do we help educators understand that, you know, there are technologies that are in the world that our kids are going to be working with. Industry has already moved on. So how do we bring that together in the K-12 classroom? I think it's pretty exciting.
It's incredible. And so on that spirit, you know, you're really focusing on what you talked about in Northern Virginia, but if you and Joseph could expand on, I've been honored. I get to see a lot of the work you're doing in person with leaders across the country and educators. When you have those educators in person and you're convening these organizations and educators around the country, what is right now like getting you most excited? And I've seen you all in person. What is filling your cup when you see the kind of movement they're making? And then what are times where you're still like, it's really deflating or it drains your battery? What are things that you see in both of those phases? Joseph, what have you been noticing out there?
I mean, I've been really impressed with the degree that educators are willing to experiment and try things that are new to them they've never done before. You know, educators are busy. They got enough going on. They don't need new things in their lives. Yet they understand that this technology is so powerful that they've got to get their arms around it. And so when I see them digging in, it really heartens me. I also love to see places where students as AI creators is already coming to the forefront. So rather than just thinking about AI as like a tutor or something like that, they think of AI as a tool that a student can use to do something amazing. So for example, we run an innovator challenge, and it's for students, and we run it every year, and they submit an app that they've created with AI that addresses one of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. And one of the examples of that is there was a team in Mexico that created a glove that digitizes hand movements and then translates it into ASL, Spanish ASL, which can then, using AI, translates it into any language. I mean, it's amazing. We could not do that in the past. Oh, I just about knocked over my water. I'm so excited. That's the kind of thing where I start to really see the potential. The draining side of things comes when we get into all or nothing debates around this technology. Either we think everything should be AI and it should be everywhere and it should take over everything, or we think we should just ban it. I really think that's a waste of time. None of us want to use technology all the time for everything, and all of us would be lost without technology some of the time. And so I wish we could get past some of those extreme positions.
Absolutely. Jessica?
I get really excited when I see educators willing to try things. And when you hear them say things like, after 24 years of teaching, I feel energized. That is the thing that really, really fills my bucket, right? When I hear people saying, I feel like I'm getting to the place in teaching that I always wanted to be, and I'm 24 years in. So that's super exciting. And I hear stories like that all the time. I've across the country, across school districts, when teachers are starting to use these technologies and think differently about their instruction and using some of the efficiency of AI in transformative ways, that's what really, really gets me excited. I think for me, what drains my battery is how complicated we've made this in many instances, right? So instead of thinking about this as another tool that can support instructional practice that we always know, it has become this giant thing that, and a little bit to Joseph's point, right? Like there's this debate about whether it should be all in or not. And it's, I think that part to me is the discouraging piece, because I see that if one person can pick it up, use it for one small thing, and then change one little piece, it starts, you know, it lights that fire. But if we make it this giant debate and this, we have to have all these things in place. No, we have to have safe, responsible, ethical use in place, but it doesn't take, you know, for lack of a better term, an act of Congress to make that happen. There are small things that can happen that make a really big difference that get people excited about it.
I have a follow-up question to that, because I think in all of our practice in different ways, we're encountering people who are kind of all in and people who are hesitant. And I'm curious what you're seeing when you run into educators who are resisting AI. Is it a resource thing? Is it a time thing? Is it a fundamental belief thing? Is it an overwhelm? I'm curious what you're seeing and what your read is on that.
I'll jump in and just start, and then Joseph, you can feel free to share some thoughts. So I think it depends on the person. So some people are very philosophically opposed to AI because they're very worried about cognitive offloading, which is a real thing. If you don't design your activities in the right way, you absolutely can use AI as a tool to just do your work for you, right? I think that is a thing, but it's not that different from what we might have said Google could do, you know, five years ago. But so that's one piece of it. A lot of people are very, very concerned about the environmental impact of AI and are just kind of opposed to it because they can't get past that piece of it, right? Some people haven't had training, and so they're like, I'm just not comfortable with it. I haven't had time to play with it myself. I don't know how this could be used as an educational tool. I don't understand it. And so I'm just not ready to go there yet. And then some people are just more hesitant thinking about where it could go. Some of the science fiction pieces of it, they're like, I don't want to depend on it at all, even if I do understand it and do see the value in it, because I'm scared of what it might be down the road. So those are just some of my, I don't know, my observations.
Yeah. And those are, you know, those are legitimate, right? And I think we just have to be careful that we don't act as if the objections are naive. There's a lot of learning science that says that learning happens best when two humans are working together with each other to support our learning process. And if AI is interrupting that, then yeah, that's concerning, right? And people should be concerned. And so I think while there's a range of concerns, I feel a lot of empathy for those who are concerned that we are watering down the human aspects of teaching and learning.
Just to pull on that thread about cognitive offloading, I learned something this week that actually totally changed the way that I talk about using AI for educators that I'll share here and get your take on some of the cognitive offloading things. But forever, you know, a bunch of us who do AI literacy and talk to people tell people to use AI to get you started, right? And then you can kind of take your human whatever and work on it, and kind of this AI sandwich idea that I used to teach. And I read a study this week about London cab drivers. It's been around since the early 2000s, about how London cab drivers don't die of Alzheimer's because they have to write this exam that takes 4 years to study for and memorize every route in London. And it makes their hippocampus bigger. But what they recently found out, like just last year, is the reason that works for them is because of how they think through their routes. The human part of thinking through what are the main junctions, what are my main pivot points and my strategy to get from here to there, and then they fill in the side streets as they go. And those actual thinking through the junctions and coming up with the plan yourself, and the easy stuff comes later, actually changed the way that I think about cognitive offloading, and realizing that using AI to get you started might actually be sabotaging us. Instead, we need to be thinking through the complexities and the routing and the benchmarks and the streets, and creating that strategic plan in our mind and then using AI to fill in the side streets. So it just goes to show exactly what you were saying, Joseph, about the learning science that we're learning all the time and how AI is supporting. But I'm curious on your thoughts about that, Joseph. It looks like you have some.
I mean, first of all, that is a fascinating study, and I really want to read it because I knew about the cab drivers, but I had not heard this update. So I think that is a potential implication, right? Another way that I think about framing this is, you know, when we think about AI and how we're going to use it, I think ultimately we're going to become AI conductors, right? So right now we're sort of like, we learn, you know, the analogy is you're learning to play an instrument, right? You're learning to do this thing or that thing or that thing. In school, it's like divided into like math or science or reading or whatever. And then when we use AI tools today, we tend to go to one tool and ask it one question, get one answer, and then do something with it, right? Which I think is kind of the workflow that maybe you're referring to, Rebecca. Ultimately, I think what we're going to find is that we have AI agents, and each one of them is very powerful and can do very specialized things. And it will be our job to figure out how to apply this problem across the agents. And in my mind, that's a very similar planning process to the cab drivers, right? So in the end, we might still bring in AI fairly early in the process, but we'll do it once we have a mental map of how we want to bring it into our problem space.
I also think it depends on the task that we're doing with AI, right? So this is something that I've been thinking about a lot. And I think that as I've heard trainings and been part of trainings and have delivered trainings, I think there's a real risk in giving, like, this is how you should do it. Because I think that it depends on the task. It depends on how we want to interact with this technology. And there's so many different uses of it that I think that there are absolutely times where you have to have your mental map in place. I also think that there are times that if you're completely stuck, getting AI to help you create that mental map and working together with it could also be beneficial. I just think it really depends on your level of expertise that you're approaching a problem with. It depends on your level of interest. It depends on your, you know, how invested you are. If it's not a task that really matters to you, then I think you're going to use AI in ways that's really different from a task that you feel very passionately about. And so a lot of times when we are doing training with educators, we're not even talking to them about AI. We're talking to them about, we have these 8 transformational learning principles that we reference often as an organization. And, you know, one of those is to create authentic experiences for students. If we want to shift and think about AI as a tool to really help our kids and help them build academic integrity, they have to care about their assignments. They have to care about the learning that they're doing. So we have to make it authentic. We have to give them agency with it. And so I really think that that's kind of where, you know, our use of this technology is going to be on us for how we design these learning experiences for students.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, something that we got to experience in the fall in Charlotte, which was the first time I had ever done it, and many of the educators, you know, in collaboration with ISTE-ASCD and Generation AI, which I, in a moment, would love for you to share this incredible work you're leading and the impact you're trying to have. We did, for the first time, ask people, like, these education leaders specifically, to like think through a problem of practice, then try to use just an AI tool alone to try to think through it deeper and ask questions to it. Then just speak to a human, like another member of the cohort, then like utilize AI again and kind of show them like there's different portions, and then ask everyone about that experience. Like, what was the benefits of talking to an AI tool specifically? And then what was the benefits of talking to one individual and then a team and then sharing out? And I think what was really rich was, similar to what y'all said, is like the times when they're talking to an AI tool can get you maybe more technical, or if you're using it correctly, it can have you like ask different perspectives about what you've already input and know. But when they talk to other humans who had been in similar shared experiences, they ask really nuanced questions that are like, you had to have kind of like had that thing either go wrong or go right, and it really made an imprint on you emotionally to be like, what about that? And that was interesting because both of those are really useful. And they mentioned like 2 different ways, but by utilizing it together, it really lets you move further along in the process. So just totally rationalizing and agreeing with like, there's got to be the right rationale and use case for when you're using it and when not to use it and then why. And I think we're getting there. But I'd love, Jessica, and then obviously Joseph as well, could you share a little bit about what Generation AI is, the work ISTE-ASCD is, and some of maybe your incredible partners who are working alongside you?
Yeah, sure. So Generation AI is an initiative that we launched gosh, it's been about a year and a half ago, which is crazy. And it is work that we have multiple funders. Google.org is a funder. General Motors is funding us. And we've partnered with six amazing organizations. We have partnered with the Center for Black Educator Development, Computer Science Teachers Association, Indigitize, Latinos for Education, the NEA, and PlayLab. And with those coalition partners, we are really trying to reach over 200,000 educators to really help them think about teaching and learning in an age of AI and help them be prepared to lead in this work. So we're doing all different kinds of activities. We've divided the work, which I really love this. We've divided the work into deep learning experiences. So Brett, which you kind of mentioned, are convening in Charlotte, was kicking off a year-long experience with educators, a community of practice, and we go deep with them. So we have deep learning experiences. We have courses where folks spend several months with us, with facilitators, really digging into this in a deep way. We have some that are foundational that maybe are not quite so deep, but we're still getting a foundation with them. So it could be some trainings, some courses, different things that we have to offer. And then we have what we call sparking engagement. So we know that, you know, this is going to be the largest group of folks that we reach because it's hard to spend enough time with that many people to get a giant reach. So we're sparking engagement by sharing videos of the work that we're doing. We've interviewed a lot of educators. We are creating videos that kind of summarize the activities we're doing just to get people's thoughts out there. We've probably had 300,000 views on our videos to date. And then we're also working on updating a framework that we have that helps educators evaluate ed tech tools. And it was created before AI was really part of a lot of ed tech tools. And so we're updating that framework to put some indicators in there when you have a tool that now all of a sudden has this AI feature pop up in it. How do you make good decisions about ed tech tools? And so we've started to publish some insights that we've gotten from educators, because we started that work by actually going and asking the field, what do you think should be included in this work? What are we missing? What needs to be in there? And so we've had several hundred thousand people look at those insights. People are very interested in this idea of how do we choose the right tools? And I think that because AI is embedded in so many tools and schools already have a lot of these tools and now AI is showing up, they're really thinking about how do I protect my students? How do I make good financial decisions for our schools and our districts? How do I make sure that these tools are really connected to the pedagogical practices that we want to promote? So that's some of the sparking engagement work that we're doing, but it's really exciting. PlayLab has been doing courses and providing folks with tools. The NEA has created some free online courses that folks can take part in. We've done webinar series with them. Center for Black Educator Development, Latinos for Ed, and Computer Science Teachers Association have all done these awesome communities of practice with their members and, you know, the folks that are in their organization. So it's been a really great collaborative effort that we have gotten in the middle of here.
I want to pick up a little bit on something you were talking about with the, choosing good ed tech tools, because like the average district has over 2,000 ed tech tools right now. And this is something that as an AI ethicist, especially like specializing in education, this is something I think about a lot because my work is in the UK and the ed tech industry works a lot different here. But there was a report that came out last year that is actually one of my favorite. It's a forecasting report commissioned by the Government of Canada about all of the forecasting and foresight connecting to AI. And one of the big risks that they flag is that data collected about children will follow them for the rest of their lives and impact the rest of their lives. And that certainly is one of the biggest risks of a lot of these ed tech tools, right? Is student data, how it's being protected, how it's being used and sold and traded, you know, like what's happening in the background, how many hands it changes. Besides that, though, tell us a little bit more about what you're telling people about vetting the tools that they use and how they use them, because that is a question that I get a lot, certainly from education leaders who have to sign off on these things and basically assume all the risk through the existing legislation, right? But what advice are you giving educators and education leaders, both of you? Joseph, any insights there?
Yeah, I mean, so as you point out, this is a really tough area. And it was hard enough to vet those 2,000 tools. And I'm not sure if there were 2,000 tools in a district that those were being vetted anyway. But people who are serious about vetting tools have to look under the hood, right? And it's hard to look under the hood of an AI tool because a lot of, I mean, the bottom line is we don't know why generative AI tools work. We are, as a species, still trying to understand them. And that's a pretty heavy thing to like consider. And once again, this validates concerns that people have about generative AI, right? And I just want to be clear. I hear that. That said, there's a lot that we can do to try and get a read on some of this. So some things that we can do. Number one, we can ask for and demand transparency from the provider. What engine are you using? How is it trained? What's the source data? What filters are you using to mitigate bias? And then when you get to the privacy question, is the things that are being inputted by the users being used to train your AI engine or not? Where do you store that data? When for how long do you store it? When do you destroy it? Et cetera, right? And many of those tools, many of those questions we'd ask of non-AI tools, but they're even more important in an AI setting. And then I think once you sort of get past the basic, how is this thing made and are you giving me privacy? There's of course security questions, but those are pretty analogous to other edtech tools of where you're storing it and who has access and that sort of thing. But then I think you have to ask questions about what pedagogy is represented by this tool. Did anybody think through the educational theories and philosophies that went into it? And you know, which ones was it trained on? And this is again, it's not usually a question you ask about an edtech tool, but it's something you need to ask about these tools. And then I think finally, I would say you really need to do a little bit of, you know, red teaming. And so this is, of course, a term from the security field where you actually try and break it, right? And I think if I were bringing an AI tool into my school, I would certainly have some adults spend some time trying to send it off the rails, just to make sure that all the bumpers and the safeguards that have been in actually work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're you know, some of the questions that we're asking folks to consider. So, you know, we have not yet put our updated framework out there for how to evaluate. That's coming in 2026. Stay tuned. But we've asked some questions, right? So we've gotten some of these insights, and so, you know, we're looking at what is the impact on teaching? What is the impact on learning? What is the impact on the ed tech design with these AI tools? And then what is your implementation strategy for them? So those are kind of the four big areas that we're thinking about with this work. And so, you know, one of the examples that I think, you know, when Joseph talked about some of the pedagogy pieces, we're asking questions like, how does this product allow for greater personalization of the learning experience at an individual student level, right? And like, how might it lift learning for all students? So those are some of the things that we're asking people. Don't just think about how, you know, how much it costs, how long does it take to learn how to use, you know, some of these pieces, but think about what actually is this tool going to do for teaching and for learning, and use that as some of your decision-making points.
I'm looking forward to reading that when it comes out, Jessica. Keep me posted on that. So I'm always kind of the negative Nancy on this. So I'll take like a plot twist here and just ask you what you're seeing right now that's genuinely exciting you about AI and the possibilities. Is there a new tool? Is there a new system? What are you seeing that's genuinely exciting you out there right now?
Thinking specifically about a tool, I mean, and it's funny because this is probably the place where we spend the least amount of our time when we're working with educators. We purposefully don't talk a lot about tools. We know that tools are part of this whole thing, and we know that you have to use them. But really, this is about a fundamental shift in the way that we think about teaching and learning. And so I do want to preface it with that. But I've been excited lately just about all of the different potential that Notebook LM has, just because it seems like such a versatile tool. It's, you know, it's very easy to use. And it keeps changing. Every time I open it, I'm like, oh, there's a new feature. Oh, there's a new feature. So it just, you know, I've personally been excited about Notebook LM.
So I'm going to try not to mention any specific tools because we try and sit. Sometimes we talk about ISTE ACD as the Switzerland of the edtech space. But there, so one thing that I have heard that I think is really fascinating is there's a tool out there that was designed to capture students, you know, sort of handwriting when they were doing math problems. There's more than one tool that does this. And then, you know, analyze that. And that is already cool because, you know, in the past, there really wasn't a way for a tool to sort of capture that authentic work that a student's doing. But the thing that really captured my attention is that same tool allows them to do a think aloud protocol and talk through what they did. And the teachers were telling me that the ability to, you know, when the tool shows that a student's made an error, they can jump to the place where the student's talking about it has been incredibly enlightening for the teacher. And I just think, what a great application of AI to connect an educator to the out loud thinking of a student on a particular problem. And it's not the sort of thing that you think about first when you think about an AI tool, but it's exactly the kind of thing that AI enables that just wouldn't be logistically feasible otherwise.
It is so interesting that you bring that up because I don't know how closely you follow the news. This is what I do full time. This is all I hear about and read about and think about. But Johnny Ives has teamed up with OpenAI to come up with this mystery device that they are, OpenAI and him are building. He was obviously like behind the iPhone. And it's been this mystery, but there's been some leaks that it's actually a pen that will sit on your desk, capture the things you're doing, encourage people to write and capture what they're writing and work exactly like you've described. Just the word nerd in me laughs at the OPEN, right? Like OpenAI. But you know, I can see that really being great in the way that you've described. And I'll bet that that's exactly what it is to kind of force us to go back. We know the connection. Well, I do anyway, I don't learn properly unless I'm taking notes as I read and unless I'm thinking with a pen in my hand. And the way you've described sounds really great. We'll have to see. I'll certainly try it out. I try everything out, but it'll be fascinating.
Well, I hope that you've parked openai.com somewhere, Rebecca, so you can sell that back to them for millions of dollars.
Brilliant, brilliant.
Oh, boy. Well, this is an excellent segue because we can see the puns are flowing and sounds like you have the same wit as Rebecca does. So we are now going to do a fan favorite part of the AMP211 podcast where Joseph and Jessica, you are now the co-host of the AMP211 podcast. You get to ask any question, any burning question that you have for Rebecca and I about anything in the space that you think our listeners would want to learn about. The floor is yours.
I've been really excited about this part of the podcast because let's face it, both of you are AI experts and you're just, you know, in the middle of it. So the thing that I think about a lot is, you know, how are we engaging parents in these conversations? How are we engaging families in these conversations? How do we bring the voices to the table that are being left out, that feel left out, and that if we don't bring into the conversation, we're going to find ourselves with a lot of friction moving forward. So what is the right way to do that?
I have thoughts on this. My background before this is actually public engagement and working in school comms. And Brett and I actually taught a session in the UK about this. And when we helped a school district in California write a policy, this is the strategy that I employed. I believe in a framework called, it just left my mind, but it's appreciative inquiry. Yeah, appreciative inquiry framework, which basically involves the whole community, student community, educators, like everybody involved. And you work through it from a positive lens. What do you love about our school or in our district? If everything goes right, what does that look like? What do we absolutely want to keep the same? What, you know, all these positive questions, there's all these categories. And then you build a shared vision for the future together. And you work towards it, kind of from that place of aporia, you know, where we don't know, but we're going to figure it out together, but looking to the future with positivity and bringing absolutely every single voice to the conversation and having those regular benchmarks and transparency and communication around that. I think sometimes we get so used to thinking, oh, we have to know everything and act like we know everything, but going into it as a learner is so important, and it's uncomfortable that in messy in-between space that all of our favorite theorists talk about, but that even in transformational learning, Jessica, you know, that disorienting dilemma everybody's experiencing at the same time right now that we have to work through, but bringing everybody along for the ride is so important. And then you get less, and this is what I tell districts too, just from even a public relations standpoint and relationship building standpoint, you get less pushback if you're transparent, that you don't know, that you're, we all agreed that this is what we want and this is what we love. And so this is what we're doing because we want to get here. But charting that course together, I think, is critical, and asking questions and listening the whole way. It's easier said than done, but I think, and having those conversations with students, I think we talk, and parents, honestly, we talk so much about the educators, we talk a lot about the students, but we're dealing with a generation of parents often like our age, right? Like, we didn't grow up with a cell phone or social media, or like, I got my first email address in college, you know, like a lot of people who aren't digital natives, who when their kid comes home and says, I failed this test because they think I used AI, they don't know what that means. And so they don't know to be defensive or not defensive or go after the school. Like, until everybody's on the same page and we build that baseline level of understanding and literacy and the shared vision and shared expectations, it just makes it all so much easier. Easier said than done, but I do really like appreciative inquiry as a starting point and as like a framework to work within.
I love it. Thank you. There's a lot of wisdom there. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a tough one as always to follow. Next question, I would prefer to go first because she's always intimidating. But so similarities, right? So previously as a principal, not knowing the name of this framework that Rebecca introduced me to, I often would start with that. I would pre-AI, I would literally sit down my staff and I would let open door policy, anyone come into my office during like certain times of the year, and I would do 5 good minutes and I would just take freehand notes. You could tell me anything. I'm not going to talk. Anything that would help move the school forward in support of the community, our mission, our values, and any stakeholder could do that. Now, a lot of the work that we do, we're doing this in a number of states with districts. When we build community AI playbooks, while there's, you know, frameworks such as ISTE standards that we obviously use, really it goes into questions like from the Rhythm Project. And we ask a specific question. So again, like, would you be okay if teachers used an AI chatbot to prepare for a difficult conversation with a parent? Now, we know there's no right or wrong answer to that per se, right? You don't need to use an AI chatbot to do so. But what you hear afterwards will surface whether they think that strengthens or erodes human connection. It will surface people's values. And what we keep on sharing with parents, especially when I lead parent workshops, I always start with, give me one word about how you feel about AI in education right now. And typically it's like apprehensive, scared, uncertain, curious, but scared. And by the end of those, we usually get to things like, I'm empowered, I'm fascinated, I'm ready, I want to try. And what you do in that hour really comes down to just listening, and usually through pre-work, asking people, what is the most challenging part about being a parent to your child today in the age of AI? So if they bring up homework, I teach them how you can take a picture of your child's homework that day. And I always use math because my son is a math wizard and he just doesn't think anyone in our family understands math because we don't use the same words as his teacher and we didn't grow up with Common Core math. So I take a picture of it and I just prompt any AI tool and say, imagine if you were a parent, you know the answer to this, but you don't know how this child learns it in his school. I just take a picture of the front of the book. I say, I assume that my child's teacher has the like teacher's edition of this book. What word should I use to guide them? Imagine you're the best teacher in the world. Don't give them the answer. But that helps me because sometimes I look at it and I'm like, I don't know what the actual, like, what do they want as an exemplar? So it helps me get the exemplar and then figure out how to use his words, but never give them the answer. A lot of that's usually what comes up on calls when I ask people, what do you want to do in real time with AI? It's that. So I go, great. Someone go take a picture of their kid's homework that they had an argument with their kid about. Let's do it live. The other thing I do a lot is teach people present parenting. And that's simply, and you know, Jessica's seen me do this at many things, take out your iPhone or any device, just hit voice memo, it creates a transcript, turn it over, and beforehand, either your college advisor or I take on the role of a college advisor and I have people role play, what are the questions that you should be asking your child about college or career or their future? And then just don't have any screens out, don't Google something in the moment, just have a free-flowing conversation, take that, throw it into whatever AI tool you want, don't say each other's name, so there's no PII, and just see the map it creates and then what questions spark from them. And I do that in real time. So basically, based on the demographic or the age of people, I try to ask what they want to, what their frustration is, show them a very quick, low-tech solution that actually brings humanity back together. And then the last thing I try to show people is, how do you overcome biases in AI? And the thing I have found that works the best is have someone describe their child in the future, living their dream, or describe them now in the way that you most love them. And by getting people to realize what kind of ways you have to prompt an AI tool to overcome biases, just keep asking them. And if you're not sure, I literally show in real time, maybe I don't know what question. So you just ask it. I want to create a culturally relevant picture of my daughter. What questions should I ask myself? And then we just do it live. And I just take that transcript, I put it in, and then they refine it. And we show people, like, this is how you can use AI in a number of different ways. That's really about you and the child, but it's starting with what they want to accomplish. So those are low lift ways to get people excited about, okay, if I can do this, then what else can I do? So that's how I've been trying to engage people and bring the humanity back.
So there's a really cool thing here, I think, across both of your answers that I'm just like pondering, is you are both saying we need a whole lot more input from people into the conversation, into the tools. I think a lot of us, when we see AI tool, we're like, oh my goodness, it's like the Oracle. It's supposed to know everything. I just need to ask it a question. And you are giving the opposite advice. You're saying, bring your ideas, bring your hesitations, bring your problems, bring your perspectives, bring that first, and then engage the tool. I just think that's such a smart reversal.
Wow. Thank you for encapsulating that. That was actually what we've been trying to say, but you said it much more concisely and better. So thank you. Good hosting. Wow. Jessica, good luck.
So I guess my question for both of you is, where do you see the biggest gap right now between like the vision for AI that you guys are kind of putting out there and classroom reality? So where do you see that gap?
So first I'm going to start with like what I'm hearing and seeing, but mostly, you know, when we talk about what drains our battery, I think it's like the uphill battle. So for example, this is a good example of how we use the community AI playbooks. I truly do not want a child on a screen unless it's like there's a clear rationale that this is a better use of their time for whatever the outcome is than not being on a screen. That being said, at a certain age level, I do think you need to start scaffolding in AI literacy skills, which can start free screen, like I just mentioned. You can have conversations. So a good example is I just presented to about 20 Bronx principals today, and I was showing them some of the work I do. So like one of them is aligned to writing standards, showing students in their future. So all I did was with a safely approved tool, have students put an image of themselves in, then write about their future goals and career that aligns to New York State writing standards in fifth grade and the test they have to take shortly. And then that picture, we then extrapolate that into the future and we have the child interacting with their adult version of themselves. So for example, if they're painters, they're painting together, or they're brain surgeons and they're like in a hospital together helping patients. And it's like mind blowing and they love it. And then they're like, well, how could I do it here? And so what I'm noticing is everyone has students writing fifth grade writing assignments. But like by adding this little nuance that takes virtually no time and is just one additional portion, changes the whole dynamic of it. So I really like to start with like, what do you want kids to learn? And even if you don't change that, how do you now think from an AI mindset? So similarly in AP courses, we did this at this district in California last year, and I still use it really anywhere I coach about pedagogy. Is like, okay, fine. You want to teach the exact same AP Lit essay you taught last year? Great. Take that AP Lit writing sample that you were going to do tomorrow in class. Tell the students the day before, I want you to use any AI tool you want. I want you to jailbreak, cheat on this exam. Green light tonight. then take whatever is the most important aspects you learned on how to ace this test and put it onto, you know, a Google Doc, one page. Tomorrow, yellow light, you can take all that synthesized information and study it for 10 minutes. Now, that's not different than when I was in high school with an index card. Same thing. Your teacher said, here's the test tomorrow, open book at night, one index card to study before you go in, and then everything's off, right? Green light, yellow light, red light. But with AI, after now red light, you take the 20-minute writing sample, and now you have time left in class, you pass it up. Now you say with consent, hey guys, let's have a Socratic seminar, or let's have an open discussion. How did y'all cheat last night? Oh, Rebecca, you know, made a mind map in Notebook. You turned it into a podcast. You made a video. I made a charts out of it. And I just learned everyone's personalized learning style. How does AI help their brain work? If you record that and you put it into like a Notebook LM or any tool, you now know how each of your period classes learns, and then you can differentiate the assignments, nothing different, the same standards, but by like scaffolding it and then listening, the sky's the limit. And there's tools out there that do that. So that's what I'm hoping to get people to, is like, you don't want to change. I understand why, and you're comfortable, and you think this assess is a skill that's important, and maybe it is, and maybe it's what the state requires. So let's build around that mindset, and let's get you to learn more about your kids, or to like make them feel more excited and like they're engaged, as you said before, Jessica. That's how I've been trying to get them to think about how do you move forward purposefully and then not feel like kids are not able to do the same skills pre-AI. And there's validity to that. So that's what I'm trying to do, is meet people where they are and build the fun stuff around it, and then hopefully inspire and unlock some thinking there.
I think the biggest gap that I'm seeing is like I think Jessica already brought it up. It's almost that binary mindset that people have, that AI is a cheating tool, or you have to either be for or against AI. And my son came home from college this week, and he was working on an assignment. And I said, well, let's use Notebook LM a tool that I had built that I use for my own to test my own understanding, to have a conversation with you, to help you identify like how you feel about this content or your unique perspective and angles. Like, it will just engage you in a Socratic line of dialogue. And he said, no, I'm not allowed. And I'm like, what do you mean you're not allowed? In his actual course syllabus, it says AI tools are prohibited for generating ideas or summarizing or to help you in any way with any understanding of texts. And I struggle with that, because I think that there's this... obviously, there's just this huge gap between of understanding. That's essentially what it is. And I'm sure his professor believes that AI tools are cheating, or perhaps like maybe is fundamentally against putting texts into an AI model for a variety of reasons, right? Like, that I completely understand. But also the why was never established as to why that was the reason, which is a different thing. But I think conflating the idea of AI to write your assignment for you and AI as a thought partner to engage you in deeper learning or deeper engagement with primary texts, I think is the point. I think that's the best possible way to use it. That's how I use it. I use it to challenge my thinking and my ideas. The taxi driver paper I read earlier, I set up a PhD level thought assistant, and I have it challenge me, and I have it ask me questions to think about things differently and challenge my worldviews. And I find that very, very useful, understanding that college kids and high school kids are programmed to find the path of least resistance, right? So I think that's kind of the biggest gap that I'm seeing, is just that binary framing. Either they're cheating or they're useful, and there's nothing in between. But I recognize that comes from a fundamental kind of lack of widespread understanding, or people who don't even know where to start with engaging with the tools themselves. So I understand why it's there, but that is kind of the gap that I see.
So last week, actually, we have an author, Tony Frontier. He has written several books, and you know, ISTE/ASCD is publisher for them. And so he wrote a book called AI with Intention. And one of the things, we did a webinar with him last week, and one of the things that he actually talked about that I think is super relevant to what you just said, is he said, you know, one of the things that we need to do if we're trying to create a culture of academic integrity, which is one of the things that he talked a lot about, and I totally respect that. He says, we need to help people understand what types of help they're allowed to get in general, right? So like, are you allowed to talk to an adult and get feedback on an essay? Are you allowed to talk to a peer and get feedback on an essay when you're at home? Are you allowed to Google something and get feedback, right? And so an AI tool is just one more way to get feedback. But if you haven't outlined up front the types of feedback that are actually allowed in the conversation, like just in general, because I think there's a difference between exactly what you said, using an AI tool to just do the work for you versus choosing how you get feedback and from whom or what.
Yeah, and I really love, you may have heard about this and maybe even talked about it on the podcast in the past, but I think Long Beach, the school district in Long Beach, California, they have a little app that is on their internal version of Chrome or whatever. And it helps, I think it's Laguna Beach, not Long Beach, though I'm sure Long Beach has awesome stuff too, at Laguna Beach. And so they, what they do is it helps the teacher outline their expectations for where the student is or isn't allowed to use AI. And then when the student submits the paper, it helps the student document how they did and didn't use AI. I just think that's so smart, right? You're just creating clarity and transparency on both sides. And under those circumstances, right, we can get somewhere, right? And maybe over time, the teacher will feel like, no, I want to change my expectations. And that's fine. And they can. And they just need to update this little app. I think we're afraid, right? And we feel like we need to protect. And when you are in a protective mindset, you push away risk, which pushes away innovation. And so if we can find mechanisms that help people take baby steps into the riskier world, you know, we can actually overcome some of this.
Well, and one quick thing about that, Joseph, one of the things that I love about that particular app that you're talking about is in order for them to create that app, they had to have really tough conversations about the ways in which they were going to talk about AI usage in the app, right? So it's a transparency tool, but the students actually and the teachers pick which ways they're using AI and in relation to specific instructional practices. They had to have conversations about instructional practice and what they were going to agree on and what they were going to disagree, you know, say, yes, it's okay in these situations. And if it's not okay, we're not going to include it in the little list that's on the app that we include. So I love that, yes, it's a tool for transparency with a whole bunch of thought that went into the back end of creating that before they deployed it.
Which is probably the most important part of the whole thing, right?
Yep, exactly.
And I think if we take it one step back, even like even more first principles, we have to look at how important it is that the teachers actually have somewhat of an understanding of these tools and how they work, because you can't dismiss something like Notebook LM or using AI in this way to be useful if you have never actually seen how useful it can be or experienced the limitations. And so that probably just goes all the way back to us institutions prioritizing PD, but also us taking sort of individual responsibility for our own exploration as well.
Yeah. One thing that I noticed was when I've been pushing districts to think about this, like when we create tools that allow you to like generate lessons that are aligned to all of your instructional framework and policies, what's missing is what you just mentioned, like the thoughtful conversation around when, how, and why you should use AI ethically in the classroom. And so two ways I've been pushing people to dialogue on this is, one, we're going to do this on Thursday at a school here in New York State, is interview students in middle school and high school and ask them to take a ride with you on the AI roller coaster and just ask one kid, you know, period one, what does your teacher say about using AI? Are you allowed to use AI? If so, how, why, you know, just one, like, what is your teacher saying? Oh, they say we're cheating or whatever they're saying. And then just ask them to go through their day and do that with like three or four kids and don't ask them who the teachers are. But that's one where you'll be like, wow, these kids are truly on a roller coaster. And whereas everything else in schools is like, we have all the rules and policies in place. And I always say it like, everyone knows what the cell phone policy is in all these new states. And yet this doesn't exist. And it's just a roller coaster ride. And the second one is when I work with instructional coaches is just ask your teachers the same way you encourage them or require them to have an objective or a learning standard or whatever else is part of it. Ask them to just put, what's the AI policy? What's their AI? What is their acceptable AI use for each assignment? And if you make that standardized, doesn't matter if it's even different by class to class until you come up with shared language, just the fact they have to think about it, and then you can at least push their thinking in coaching sessions on like, oh, I see you banned it outright. what if we taught them how to do this? And they're like, oh yeah, that doesn't change what I wanted them to learn, and it might make it more exciting. And that's how you can gradually get them there, even if they start at a full no, or maybe they say full yes, and it's like, hey, that's not good either. That's, these kids can just do that assignment, then maybe we need to add some nuance here about like use it here, but not here. So those are two ways I've been really pushing people to think about how difficult it is for students with no guidance and policy. Start wherever you can, but even the assignments themselves could help.
I really like how my institution, the University of Edinburgh, does it, because on every assignment, you have to clearly articulate exactly how you used AI and why. And I think that idea, just as a starting place, to think through how you're using it intentionally and explain to somebody else why you used it there and in what ways, just immediately makes us more cognizant and accountable to our use of AI. So, good place to start.
You two are off the hot seat. You did a fantastic job. Might be the best two co-hosts yet that we've had. So well done. And now we really like to turn it over to you for our final question. We've talked a lot about, you know, talking good behind people's back. So this is a great opportunity for you to do the following. And one that's great when we have two guests, because like one of you can go, and then if someone remembers something else, they can go after that person. So there's no time limit on this. But this is a great opportunity for our audience. You work with so many innovative districts, leaders, educators. Shout them out and talk good about what work they're doing. Again, institutions, districts, education leaders, whomever. And the part that we always try to get to is like, if we're building this dream, looking to the future of AI and education and innovation, like who needs to come along for the ride with us? So open question about who do people need to know about that are doing great work and why out there in the space. Take as long as you like.
Oh my goodness. So there are so many people doing good work. This is one of the things where I'm like, I'm going to leave somebody out.
And that's okay. That's okay. I promise you, listeners, that's okay. And if you're not in it, you know, you get it. This is on the spot.
So first of all, people often ask me, you know, who am I reading about AI? And so I get a lot of my information about AI from LinkedIn. There's some really great content on LinkedIn. So if you don't think of LinkedIn as a content place, it's really become one. So Ethan Mollick, who is a professor at the Wharton School, is one of the most intriguing voices on AI in education. Really thoughtful, also funny, which doesn't hurt when like Rebecca, you've been reading about AI all day, every day. A little bit of humor can help.
I knew you were going to say Mollick when you said orchestra, the conductor thing, because that's a Mollick thing. I loved it.
Yeah. And then also John Bailey. He's a really interesting person. He's been a policy person on the sort of Republican side of the House in the past. And really thinks about AI both from a learning point of view and an economic point of view. I think he brings a really interesting perspective as well. I also, another source, I read the Whiteboard Notes. So Whiteboard puts out a newsletter, and they do a pretty good job of pulling up some of the more interesting AI articles and things that are going on. There's another person that I'm going to think about while I pass this over to Jessica.
Okay, so I've already mentioned some of the people that I think are just doing amazing work in this area, and those are our coalition partners that I mentioned earlier today. I mean, they are thinking about this. And one of the things that I love, you know, in Digitize, specifically in Digitize, Center for Black Educator Development and Latinos for Education are really engaging their communities. And so they're thinking about this in ways that really impact their communities. I had the opportunity to co-present with Indigitize and some of their fellows from their community to practice. And just the thoughtfulness that the Indigenous community is approaching AI with is just, it's inspiring to me. And so I just appreciate folks kind of leaning into their own culture and, you know, the impact that their culture has on how they think about this, and, you know, creating space for people to say, I don't really want my data to be owned by these big companies. And so I'm not going to engage in this right now until we have our own data centers that are on our own lands. You know, this is some of what I'm hearing from Indigenous folks, and it's fascinating to me. And so I just appreciate the care that they come at these conversations with and the openness to listen. So you know, that's a group, our coalition partners that I want to shout out. You know, I also want to shout out the folks at the state level that I think are doing this really well. So Matt Winters in Utah is doing some awesome things. Vera Cubero in North Carolina is doing some amazing things. AJ Cote in Massachusetts is doing awesome things. And so we've had the pleasure, you know, of working with some of these folks at the state level and you know, just seeing, again, the level of intentionality of how they're engaging stakeholders. And when you work at the state level, you know, I did for 3 years, it is a challenging place to be because, you know, unfortunately, you're at the place where you sit between policy and education. And so the politics of the state get in the way sometimes of education. And so I just have so much respect for our state leaders who are struggling through this work, but thinking thoughtfully and really, I mean, being leaders in how they equip the educators in their state to work with and think about AI. There's also this guy, I think his name is Dr. Joseph South, and he has a really cool newsletter that he does on LinkedIn. Is it called Spark?
Learning Spark.
Learning Spark. I knew I was going to get it wrong, but also really cool ways just to think differently about learning. And so I appreciate the work that he's doing in this field too.
You referred to Michelle Culver earlier. I think the work that she's doing around how AI impacts human relationships and social relationships is really important. Another person that I read, and I realize, and I'm doing a theme here, these are sort of like more out of the box people, because I think we all know the usual suspects in the field already. But Allison Doolin Salisbury, which may not have come up in your feed, she, for a while, she was doing the one AI article you should read this week. And I found like she was choosing really great stuff to read. And again, I just found her on LinkedIn. That's Allison Doolin Salisbury. And if you read the one thing per week, you'll get a really great overview as well.
Wow, those are some really good finds. And thank you for bringing up people that we've all heard of. And then those hidden gems, that's really the goal of that. So you both aced it. Well done. No one come for them in the comments. Jessica, you did a great job of shouting out, you know, a great place they can learn about Joseph's thoughts on LinkedIn and his newsletter. Could you both just kindly end by just sharing with our audience once more ways they can either engage with you all in person, online, how to get involved and find all the great resources that ISTE ASCD offers?
Yeah, I'll start with generationai.org is a great place to go to learn about all of our grant-funded activities that we do. And then, you know, we have some really great membership resources as well. So ISTE-ASCD.org/AI is a great place to go and find some other things. Joseph, is there anything else? Any other places you'd send people?
I mean, those are great starting points. We have, you know, we publish a number of books from different perspectives, from the perspective of edtech coaches, from the perspective of instructional leaders, you know, from all different points of view that I think can be really, really useful. And then, you know, at our conference, I think last year we had over 200 sessions on AI and teaching and learning. And I mean, it's just, and by the way, those are 99% of those are from other educators talking about their actual experience. I think that that's a concentration of knowledge and experience that just doesn't exist elsewhere. So there's lots of ways to find your way into our community, and we hope that you'll just pick one and see where it leads you.
Amazing. Well, again, Joseph, Jessica, thank you so much for the amazing work you lead at ISTE ASCD, and thank you so much for spending time today with us on the AMP211 podcast. Thank you all so much. Everyone, thank you for listening. Have a wonderful day.